Can archaeological techniques help tackle crime?
I'm rooting around the stores at the University of Birmingham's archaeology department.
And what did Time Team's Matt Williams discover excavating the abandoned Roman city of Wroxeter?
You'll find out on the Time Team podcast.
Yes, welcome again to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek. Martin, you're not long back from somewhere exciting, aren't you?
I spent the last couple of days in Anglesey. Now, I can't say too much about exactly what was going on, but I was on an Operation Nightingale dig there. And I've just come back full of excitement for it all. I never thought I'd get so excited about lumps of metal. I never thought
Welcome to my world.
I know. And I came back going, I'm gonna buy a metal detector. I'm going to join the RAF. My life feels changed temporarily from it. But what I will say is, I saw Operation Nightingale in a renewed light. I mean, we've always known how wonderful it is for helping service personnel and former service personnel recover from mental health issues, PTSD in particular. I saw its work doing that firsthand over the last few days, and it is truly inspiring to see. It gives people an opportunity to talk openly among people that they trust and know and form a bond with, a bond that you only get between people who've served or are serving in the military. And they used archaeology, the kind of distraction almost of talking about the bit of soil that they were trying to move or, you know, whatever it might be. They used that as a way of talking about some of the things that they are struggling with. And it was really, really special. Honestly, I came back with such a sort of warm, fuzzy feeling and a real excitement as well for the archaeology.
And despite the fact that I think it's been raining all weekend everywhere, hasn't it?
Yeah, we got very wet. I will say that as well.
well done. And we really look forward to hearing more about that soon.
Yeah, I am so excited to bring that to you. It's going to be really, really good. First, though, we have talked on the podcast before about the damage that's done to sites of historical importance. And we talked about things like vandalism, farming practices, maybe illegal metal detecting. Now, intentional damage to a site can be catastrophic for archaeology and the preservation of important parts of our history for future generations.
It's a problem the police say they're determined to take seriously, but how do you tackle what appears to be a growing problem when you're covering these huge rural areas with limited resources?
Time Team's landscape archaeologist Stuart Ainsworth has been working with the police to combat what they call heritage crime. He's on the podcast now alongside PC Jono Lightfoot from Cheshire Police's rural crime team. Hello to you both.
Good morning.
Hello.
Stuart, what do we mean when we say heritage crime? What sort of things are we talking about here?
Well, heritage crime, it's any offence which causes damage to the value of heritage assets or to cultural property and their settings. It can be anything ranging from vandalism to theft to antisocial behaviour.
So what sort of call-outs then, Jono, are you getting regularly then in your team?
A range of different things. Nothing ever surprises me anymore. I particularly focus on theft of historic stone, which is where me and Stuart are working quite closely together.
Tell us a bit more about that project then with the stone. Stuart, how are you using your skills to help Jono?
It's serendipity, Helen. Sometimes, you know, you've come across something and think, maybe archaeology can help here a little bit. Lots of stone was being stolen. Paving stones in particular seem to be one particular item that is very popular to be stolen. In archaeology, we record stone all the time, don't we? We've got methods of recording them. We've got equipment like remote sensing cameras on drones. We've got LiDAR on drones. We've got multispectral cameras. So I thought, well, why can't we use some of the techniques that we've developed in archaeology for quite a long time and the ability to analyse that data. I wonder if any of this could be useful to the police, particularly with stone issues, because stone has very, very specific textures depending on what type of stone it is. Let's say a particular paving stone was stolen from a site. and half of it was left on site, which often happens. Things get damaged and another bit taken away. We've effectively got a fingerprint of one half of it, which could be compared with the other half of it if it was recovered. And that ultimately can be used for identification of that particular object.
From my point of view, it's amazing. Every day I spend with Stuart, it just blows my mind because of all the different technologies that have been used for years. It's like, why are we not doing that as the police?
The scale of what you have to try and do as a rural crime team, I imagine, Jono, is significant because you are covering, by nature of the fact it's rural, very, very large areas. You don't necessarily know where a crime is going to be committed. And if you get a tip off, it could be days later and you turn up and, well, you're never going to find them. So doing prevention is maybe a better way than being reactive.
Yeah, I mean, both has its places. I mean, prevention's always going to be the key of stopping crime, but I don't think you're ever going to stop it. You know, the police are under review all the time, budgets are being cut and things like that, so there's not as many of us that we feel like we probably should have. But we ask the public to be our eyes and ears in the countryside, because if people don't report it, we don't know it's happening. So we can't look to target that area to prevent crime from happening. So the use of heritage watch groups of volunteers from English Heritage and National Trust go out and visit heritage sites every day. So we'd be silly not to tap into that resource, because it's there, a free resource of people who care for their heritage. Archaeologists, they're visiting them all the time. So it's just valuable people who can help us, really.
There might be people who look at this initiative and say, well, shouldn't the police be focused on other things, what they might describe as more important crimes? Why do you think doing this work, protecting our heritage, is so important? Stuart, maybe this is one for you.
I'd like to sum it up in three words, actually. A heritage, it's fragile. It's a finite resource. And kind of once it's gone, it's gone. It can't be replaced. We tend to put value on things, don't we, by monetary terms. But the value of our heritage is irreplaceable. The value is not just monetary, it's the impact it makes on society and the impact it makes on individuals when they see something that they've treasured painted on or broken up. There's been any number of examples in the press recently. Started with Sycamore Gap being the most famous example, where the impact of that particular incident spread worldwide, didn't it?
Most people would see a tree as not being archaeological, but not only does it enhance the beauty of the landscape and therefore our love and our value of the archaeological site of Hadrian's Wall, it also is a piece of evidence, material evidence, showing how we have interacted with Hadrian's Wall. So I always love the way that trees are as much a bit of archaeology as a piece of stone or a belt buckle or a pot. You know, they're all grist to our mill.
I mean, we see incidents all the time, haven't we, Jono, with off-road bike, mountain biking and off-road 4x4 driving.
Yep.
We know there's an interaction between the ground and everything that grows in it. In archaeology, for many archaeologists, it's what's under the ground. But for lots of us kind of landscape archaeologists, it's everything in there. Heritage is not just archaeological artifacts, as you say, and pottery. It's everything we value from the past and the places that we live.
Some of this crime can really make enormous amounts of money for the criminals concerned. We often believe that this is not just heritage crime. This is linked into other organised crime, other organised crime markets. But that again is something that we find it really hard. I mean, as archaeologists, we find it impossible to prove. So that's definitely an area where the police are teaching us as much as we're teaching the police, isn't it, Johnny?
Yeah, absolutely. And you saying that about organised crime, we do see that. We know that the lead thieves, the stone thieves, they are organised. They travel. And people think of organised crime, they think of drug dealers and things like that. But no, in the heritage crime world, they're very much organised, down to illegal metal detecting. That's organised as well.
Well, luckily, skills like Stuart's are playing their part in catching these people. Are you now an honorary PC? How's it work, Stuart? Do you get a bat on?
There are times that I'm sure I'm not as PC as I should be, Martin. I have to say, but no, I'm effectively a volunteer. You know, I'm kind of proud to be a volunteer in helping combat heritage crime. I mean, the Time Team itself has spent many, many years investigating sites using multiple skills, haven't we, Helen? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
You know, we have everything from pottery specialists to bone specialists to geophysical survey specialists. It's never just one skill that solves our crimes, is it?
Yeah, got to be a team.
It's bringing together skills from all over the place. And now on Time Team, effectively, I've sort of recruited Jono into our Time Team brotherhood now.
Brilliant.
And I'm hoping that on our journey together through cooperating on heritage crime with the head of the Historic England's Heritage Crime Team as well, Mark Harrison, we're working collaboratively to try and see how we can transfer this knowledge that we're both accumulating and researching into combating something which we all care a great deal about.
It's a really important thing. And now Time Team Police Service is on the job. I think we've definitely got the right people for it. Stuart, Jono, thank you so much for talking us through such a complicated and at times as well, very emotional issue as well for a lot of people, especially if you're, you know, on the receiving end of some of this crime. It's a really important thing to talk about. And I know we're going to be learning more on Time Team over the coming months. So I'm looking forward to that.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
This is the Time Team Podcast. Halloween, of course, in a few days. Helen, not far away from that. On YouTube now, by the way, you can go there and watch, if you're feeling in a spooky mood, Time Team's top three haunted digs. Might be quite nice to set the scene, mightn't it? Although, to be honest, for me, I'm not into Halloween. I don't know why we should be sort of celebrating all the like death and macabre things and scary ghouls and ghosts. I don't like it.
Oh, don't you? Well, I used to hate it when I was tiny. I found all that talk of witches and ghosts and so on really terrifying. But I now feel that what we do with Halloween these days has turned it into a kind of bit of fun rather than something spooky, or rather than something genuinely spooky. We're kind of laughing at it. And that, I think, diffuses it. So I totally love it. And partly because I know I disagree with a lot of people here. I don't find trick-or-treating an American import that's just there for commercialism, because Halloween used to be celebrated in Britain. It never went away in Scotland, you know, with guising and so on. But we lost it. And so we've regained it from them rather than importing it as an alien tradition. I just really enjoy any excuse for dressing up and having fun.
You see, that's what it is. I just think it's too close to Bonfire Night. And I really, really like Bonfire Night. And I feel like as Halloween has got bigger, we have forgotten all about Bonfire Night, and that's my favourite night of the year.
I do love Bonfire Night, but where we are, certainly, we haven't lost Bonfire Night. We've got both of them. So I have already got my favourite fireworks. We don't have fireworks in our village, but all of the villages around do, and I've already got my favourite firework display in the diary. Felsham fireworks, here I come.
That's going to be very good. All right, well, maybe I need to change my tack then on Halloween and learn to embrace it. I shall do my best.
Yeah, why not? Now, Time Team's Henry Chapman is a useful man to have on a dig. This is because he has two sides to him. Firstly, he's a GIS specialist. So GIS is Geographical Information Systems. This, I feel, is a really impenetrable thing for people who aren't experts to get involved with, because it takes all kinds of geographical information, 3D, 2D, whatever, and it merges it all so that you can analyse and visualise any kind of map and any kind of landscape. Now, in the old days, Henry used to do all our geolocating. So he was the one person who knew exactly where we were on site. And obviously, that's totally essential when you're dropping something like a small trench over a geophysical anomaly, or you're trying to find the edges of a previous excavation. But these days, Henry has not worked so hard that way because that technology is easier to use, so it's available to more people. So Henry is freed up to do other things, and his proper research specialism is wetlands. So waterlogged but land-based archaeology. And that often involves coring down into sediments like he did at Sutton Hoo to establish how the river systems had moved over the years, or analysing how things like drainage patterns and agriculture and climate change are likely to affect currently waterlogged sites such as Flag Fen.
Yeah, and as part of that, Henry's been doing an awful lot of research into bog bodies, the human remains, sometimes thousands of years old, spectacularly preserved in the anaerobic conditions that are found in peat bogs. And I've been keen to learn a little bit more about Henry's work, so I've been to see him at the University of Birmingham, where he's been letting me have a little poke around in the department's stores.
Right, come on in here, and I'm going to show you where we keep all the samples and all the finds.
This is a bit of a treasure trove in here.
This is archaeology behind closed doors. this is the glamour. You've got lots and lots of tubs with soil samples. We've got a fridge here, which has got many of the samples, which we're looking particularly at things like pollen and other sort of things, which actually they degrade.
Let's open the fridge, Sharon, and have a look in here. Okay.
So in the fridge, what we've got, I mean, we've got lots of different samples from different sites, and you can see some of these are in long tubes.
So what's this? Is this a cross-section of a soil sample, a coring sample?
Yeah, this is a coring sample. So effectively, this would be sort of the, when you core vertically into the ground, this is what you take out in the core, and then you sort of put it onto this this sort of tubing. This is just normal drain pipe, but it then keeps the sample sort of in stratigraphic order, so all in the layers. So at the top, we're more recent. As you go down, you're going into the past. And what this allows you to do is to subsample it and look microscopically at what's in there. All of this stuff's organic. Anything which you leave outside will rot or degrade. If you don't keep it in the fridge below around about 4 degrees, it starts to decompose. So as you can see here, we've got, this is a reference collection, this is animal bone. Each of these little compartments are showing you the same bone, but from a different animal. So as you go across, you can compare them. They all quite often look very, very similar in terms of the details, but when you look at the overall shapes, sizes, they will differ. So each of these drawers is really just focusing on a particular type of bone. If we go to femur.
Oh, they're huge.
Yeah. So we've got everything from human to cow to
this is
pig.
This is a human.
Yeah, there's a human on one side, all the way through to much, much smaller animals. And this just allows us to, if you're analysing bone, you can compare it and work out which animal it is. So having things like this are absolutely crucial for archaeology.
So tell me a little bit about the research that you've been doing, particularly I know your work with bog bodies, which a lot of these samples here might have been from. First, explain to me, what is a bog body?
It's in the name, and actually it really doesn't help us narrow things down. It's a body found in a bog. Really, in the imagination, if you like, although there are lots of human remains found in bogs, and not all of them preserve. And the ones which always catch the headlines and the ones which people study generally are the ones which have, because of that environment, they've been really well preserved. And I mean skin, hair, you know, internal organs. The ones which are most famous come from the Iron Age, so the last bit of prehistory.
And what are you able to learn from a body that's been preserved to that degree?
It's a bit like, if you think about a crime scene, if the more you have preserved, the more you can tell. So if you just think about injuries, just to be sort of sinister about it, I was going a bit gross to begin with, but most injuries to the human body, they won't affect the bone. Yeah, so if you think about, in the case of bog bodies, slit throats, hanging, those sorts of things. Some of them, they might affect the bone, but not necessarily. Whereas if you actually have the skin, you can see those injuries themselves. You can also see other things. You can see lots of things about the stomach contents, for example. So you can see what the final meal was.
So many of these tubs, and they're all covered in dirt. Every single one of them has been labelled, and some of them have got text on them that give you a bit of an idea as to what might be inside. But each one of these pots inside this storeroom contains samples that might just tell a story.
The thing with bog bodies is everybody, for all the right reasons, looks at the body. What we do is actually say, well, let's just step back. So we actually look at the environment around the body at the time when it was deposited and try and understand what was going on.
how many of the bodies that you're finding in these bogs are there as a result of something bad happening?
Not all of them being killed deliberately. There are examples of bog bodies where, you know, there's one from Ireland, for example, where it's almost certainly an accidental death in the medieval period. These places are dangerous. This is why we have myths of, you know, Will-o'-the-Wisp and so on, you know, drawing people off the bog. When you look at that late prehistory period, you know, sort of the Iron Age, you know, slightly different parts of Europe, that's when you get the ones which seem to be quite brutally killed.
I've seen photographs of some of the bodies that have come out, the well-preserved ones, and because they're so well-preserved, you do feel this connection to them that you don't necessarily to skeletons that you unearth, because they look so human, because they've got all their flesh and their hair and everything. And I just think it's so, so interesting what you're able to work out about how they got there and the lives that they were living at that time as well.
It's the most emotional experience. There are some things which really make a connection with you. When you look into the face of, say, Tollund Man from Denmark, it's so, so immaculately preserved. You are looking at someone. It's hard to imagine he's over 2,000 years old. It's not the same as looking at a skeleton, because we don't see skeletons when we see each other. We see faces. You can see sort of all of the things which make us human. It is that really direct, very sort of visceral understanding of people. And that's what makes it such a weird thing to study as well, because it's not like other sorts of archaeology.
It's so interesting to hear Henry talk about the environment of a bog body, what the landscape was like around it. It's so important to allow us to interpret them, because we often wonder if they're there as a result of, say, ritual sacrifice or judicial execution. And of course, those may be almost exactly the same thing. But one way that we might be able to tell them apart is to look at the place that the killing or the deposition of the body took place. So was it a special place? Was it a kind of honourable place? Or was it a lonely, out-of-the-way place? And of course, that is always a matter of some interpretation. Some places that were important and honourable in the past might then go through a phase of being seen as a place of kind of derelict horror before then being rehabilitated. But every piece of data, every clue helps us to understand them.
Yeah, and it was so interesting, by the way, being in the stores and sort of seeing Henry's environment where he's working at the University of Birmingham. And I've recorded some other little bits and bobs there, and I think, you know, at some point I will share some of the other things that Henry gets up to as well with you. So that is all.
Not all of them, I hope.
Yeah, maybe not all. Maybe not all of them.
He's got a bit of a bad reputation for practical jokes.
Right, yes, maybe. Maybe not all of them, but certainly some of them we will discuss. Right then, a quick update for you now, actually, on the podcast. Last month, you might remember that we caught up with Time Team's Matt Williams, who was on site at the Attingham Park Estate near Shrewsbury. Now, he was with the National Trust excavating on the outskirts of the huge abandoned Roman city of Wroxeter.
Yes, and there's been some exciting discoveries there. So let's speak to Susie Watts, the National Trust's archaeological project manager for Attingham. Susie, hello.
Hello, lovely to see you, Helen, and speak to you, Martin.
Lovely to have you here. And remind us, what were you doing last month? What were you looking for?
So we were piloting a new sustainable project for the National Trust, working on some of the geophysics results that we have from 2023. And the site that we focused on this year is just outside of the Roman city of Wroxeter, Viriconium, in the hinterland of that city. So we were trying to identify what period that area was settled by the Romans, whether there was any prehistory in the same site, and then to answer some questions for the National Trust about how ploughing may have damaged the site and the archaeology, what depth the archaeology was at, and how accurate that geophysics was, which is really important for the wider estate.
You were putting holes in the ground, you were having a look for stuff. What did you find?
The first thing, the geophysics was spot on, which doesn't always happen, does it?
Don't say that to John Gator.
Yeah, he'll never forget it. So we found three sites that we had identified through that and other techniques. The first of which was a Roman shrine. There's been a number sort of identified potentially in that area and from previous excavations in another field. With Wroxeter, none of the walls remain. It's very much the remains of the foundation trenches. It's all been used and rebuilt into churches and buildings over the last two millennia. So it was shadows of what was there before, but very much an obvious shrine, very square with a central feature. And within that central feature, we did find, for instance, a Roman incense bowl. And we did actually locate some cremation burials outside of the shrine, but we've left those in situ to excavate if required at a later date, but there's nothing at the moment within our research aims that would want us to do that. The site also, we found some indication from some of the metalworking finds that Roman shrine might well have been in use for some period. We've got a couple of finds that we're not going to mention at the moment that were found as part of that metal detecting survey that we're going to leave for perhaps later on in our releases around our project and programme, but they were all indicative of a shrine.
Yes, well, you end up with so many different stories, don't you, from an excavation? And the story that I'm quite interested in is why Roxeter's there. I mean, did you find a precursor, a pre-Roman precursor to Roxeter?
We absolutely did. So one of our other trenches that we identified, again from the geophysics, we located an Iron Age roundhouse.
Fabulous.
It was very obvious. We hoped that's what it meant, and it did. So we found the ring ditch, quite evident, and we also found two phases of construction potentially from that ring ditch. Again, we had finds of the right date, a very small piece of Iron Age pottery, very, very small. And also we found what potentially is an Iron Age bracelet from the same area. Again, there's a little piece of that that we're not going to release at this stage. That's going to be for a bit later. But it was very much within what we think was a Roman enclosure. So we are suspecting that the Romans, when they introduce their first marching camp to the area, the military have reused some of the prehistoric landscape. And again, some of our metal detecting finds, again with the wonderful Paul Hemingway, which I know is one of your time team metal detectorists, who was an absolute star, has identified that Iron Age roundhouse is very much within a site where there's lots of metal finds that we would associate with that marching camp.
Can I ask, because one of the things that I really want to know, Helen wants to know about what Roxeter was before it was this big Roman city. I'm really interested in how it stopped being a great big Roman city, because it was kind of abandoned, wasn't it? Any clues as to what might have happened that meant everybody kind of left?
That was one of our questions to answer, one of our research questions. We were very lucky to have Dr. Roger White with us, who is the foremost expert on Roxeter and has been digging it since 1976. And he and I spent a lot of time postulating beforehand that actually this site may well have been part of our earlier occupation, and that some of the insulas may have stretched originally when they planned the city up into this area of excavation. However, it was very evident being on site, and that's why I think being on site for some length of time, and Paul and I lived on site for 2 weeks. It was very blustery. It is quite exposed, a major advantage for a military site, but probably not so much of an advantage as you go into much more of your organized city with all of your districts and your structure. So it was very, very exposed up there. It sat on top of a ridgeline. The other side of it as well is incredibly well-drained land, so very good agricultural land. So it did, we believe, return to Market Garden after the defensive wall was built in about 190 AD, and the defensive wall runs at the edge of the site. So we think that probably it was quite exposed, really good agricultural land, and also the water source was established into the centre of Roxeter. We believe that they then moved behind the defensive wall in 190 and returned it to agriculture.
That's really fascinating. And how about the geophysics? I mean, tell us a bit more about that. Is it challenging ground to do geophysics on, and what techniques were you using?
So the National Trust employed a very large-scale magnetometry survey in 2023, and it was actually as part of their nature recovery program. So looking at the estate as part of that bigger National Trust-wide program to understand how they could replant some trees in those particular areas, perhaps re-wet some of the estate. And what they didn't want to do was to affect the archaeology. So magnetometry was used because it could be done on quite a large scale. The estate is challenging in terms of geophysics because obviously there is quite a lot of woodland on the estate, there's quite a lot of different usage of the estate, and obviously you've got to work with the farmers and when you have access to different fields. The field that we were on has been pasture for many years, so it was easy to access, and also the soil is sandy, as we found out through the excavation. So yes, the results were very, very good. What we did find out was actually some of the features that we were identifying within the excavations had actually been lost within the magnetometry analysis. So the raw data, when we went right back to the raw data, we could see some of the post holes, for instance, within the roundhouse, but they'd been dumbed down as part of the analysis. It was really interesting. Matt particularly found that particularly interesting as we went back through it.
So what then needs to happen next? As I am fast learning with these big archaeological digs, it's never over until the fat lady sings. So what do you think is going to be the next little bit that you need to do here on this site?
We've got a lot of finds to process. So if we talk about the sort of short-term aspect, it's working with volunteers and it's working with the estate to process those finds and to work out what we do with some of the more complex finds. Matt's working on the report and we'll pull that together hopefully towards the end of this year. In terms of the larger scale for that site and for the Attingham estate, we are working hopefully to extend the programme beyond this season, hopefully into next season and beyond. We'll be working to decide what site would be best archaeologically, practically, and as part of that kind of wider storytelling of the Attingham estate. It's 4,000 acres and most people come to visit the house at the moment. Part of this is to tell the wider story of the estate. And there'd be an outdoor hub hopefully built in 2027 and hopefully Attingham unearthed, whether it remains on this site or another site, will find its natural home within that outdoor hub. But it is taking a while to formulate the plans for next year and cement what that looks like in archaeological terms and practical terms.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you so much, Susie, for coming and telling us all about it. It's been really interesting to hear about.
No, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you and hopefully, you know, there'll be more to tell in the future months and years.
Okay, I'm going to get to questions in just a second because I've got lots of them here, as usual, from Time Team members. But firstly, I just wanted to quickly mention Sutton Hoo. It's sort of been, I think you'll agree, Helen, Time Team's sort of spiritual home, hasn't it, over the last couple of years now, really. And I know loads and loads of people are interested in it and just really want to consume any additional information that there is about Sutton Hoo. So I did want to very quickly tell you that Sir Tony Robinson, on his podcast, Cunningcast, has got a special episode out right now all about Sutton Hoo. And he's got guests, Professor Martin Carver and Laura Howarth as well, with him talking about the history of Sutton Hoo, really setting it in a little bit of context. It's a really interesting listen. It's available to listen to on Cunningcast right now. Time for the questions, and these have been sent in by Time Team members. Thank you very much if you've done that. If you want to contribute to future editions of the podcast and ask your question to Helen, you can do that. Just become a Time Team member and head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial for all the details. Drew Calderwood has got in touch and says, I was wondering if Helen could explain what happens to the finds in the Portable Antiquities Scheme once they've been catalogued and processed. Are they conserved by the PAS? Do they return to the person who discovered them? Are they directed to local, regional, or national museums? Who decides where they end up and how they'll be shared with the larger community?
Well, Time Team, really, it's simply an excavation like any other. It just happens to be an excavation that we film. So it's treated in exactly the same way as any other excavation. So that starts off with a discussion beforehand. We need to draw up an agreement with the landowner to talk about the finds as part of the archive. The feeling within archaeology is that finds should stay with the records and the drawings and the soil samples and so on. So the whole package of what remains after the excavation has been finished is all together. So everything that we find needs to go into that archive. The idea is that the archive should replace the site so that the things that can't be kept, like the soil, are replaced by records. But the finds, because those are things we can keep, are kept. And that can be really hard for a landowner to get their head round because they think the records are somehow different from the finds. I think it comes down to the fact that the records are made of paper and so probably aren't very valuable, but the finds are actual tangible pieces of, in some cases, art, which maybe have a market value. So you can understand how this mindset comes about. We can't force the landowners to allow the finds to stay with the rest of the archive because the finds, in common law, they belong to the landowner. But we can really, really encourage them to put them with the rest of the archive. So moving on to the where they go, each excavation will have a different place that the archive should go to. So normally that's going to be to the relevant county archive. And those have in the past been publicly funded, but because they do cost a lot, you know, it's not free to find a place to put these things and then look after them. So these days there are often charges to deposit them. So that's another line in the budget that we have to cope with. And you also asked about conservation. And again, it's the excavator's responsibility to make sure that the finds can go into the archive for posterity. So they have to be stable. But then they're handed over to the museum or to the store. And then it's the museum or the store's responsibility for how they're shared with the wider community. And actually, you did mention the PAS, the Portable Antiquities Scheme, but we don't get involved at all. We're a project, speaking with my PAS hat on for the time being, but we're a project to record finds made by members of the public. So those are finds that don't have this infrastructure, this system of an excavation of a proper research project to fit into. They're stray in a sense. They don't come with an archive. They don't come with somebody who has a responsibility to put them into a store. So we're the kind of repository of last resort in a way. Finds from an organised archaeological project. Well, the whole organised archaeological project has got to organise right up to the end, right up to the finds are there for posterity with the archive, and then we can all go home feeling that the job has been finished.
And it always is finished as well. That's the thing, isn't it? I know how meticulously the correct records are done and things go in the proper bags and are sent off to all of the right places. It's a sort of well-oiled machine in that way. Thank you very much, Drew. Great question. Jenny has the final one of the episode. Jenny says this: if Time Team could go back to a dig from each season and have an extra 3 days now, what would they be? Well, I'm going to intervene here because I think we might be here until next Tuesday if we go through every season. So, Helen, I'm going to allow you to pick just one dig, one excavation that you are allowed to return to for another 3 days. Where are you going and why?
Well, I think it's really the big sites that we could do a more effective evaluation on if only we had more time. So I don't think it's going to be a really rich site like, say, Bremer. That needs a full years-long project on it. But where we can add value is we could go back to a really big site and do more evaluation. So find out more about condition, date and extent, as Mick always used to say. Find out more about how the site works, its phasing and so on and so forth. Those tend to be the Roman villas. And the site that I am desperate to go back to is Broughton Roman Villa. It was so big. I mean, it was one of the biggest Roman villas ever discovered. So recently discovered that we were the first people to do any proper evaluation on. I feel that there's so much more there before the project closes. You know, we can tie it up, as we were talking about, with archives and deposit an archive. But in no way have we got to a point where we ought to stop and say, now we've thoroughly evaluated it and we'll leave it for somebody to do a big area excavation. We could add loads of value if only we had 3 more days there.
Well, Helen, you never know, do you? You
see, no, this is my public pitch for more resources for Broughton.
That's it. We may at some point, who knows, in the future. And if Time Team members want it enough as well, you know, we could make a return there. Thank you very much, Jenny. And thank you, Drew, as well. Thank you for those questions. If you want to ask your question on a future edition of the podcast, now's the time to get in touch, become a Time Team member, and then you can go to Patreon and there's a special chat section where you can add your question there. It's patreon.com/timeteamofficial where you need to go.
And that's about it for this week. On our next episode, I'll be answering more of your questions, including a discussion about the technology that everyone seems to be talking about at the moment, AI, and how it might help archaeology.
Everyone is talking about AI at the moment. It sort of does my head in, but I know it is really important. And I know that there could be some really interesting stuff and what it might mean for archaeology to come out of it. So hope you can join us for that next week. And from Helen and myself, thanks for listening to the Time Team podcast.